in various magazines and periodicals, and there are at least 6 books of which she is the author. For example, Daughters and Rebels, an autobiography, The American Way of Death, she took on the funeral industry in that, The Trial of Dr. Spock, the FBI and the United States Department of Justice were subject to her views, Kind and Unusual Punishment, about the US prison system, A Fine Old Conflict, and then Poison Penmanship, The Gentle Art of Muckraking. We're going to find about the inside of it, though, tonight. She, in 1972, received the Guggenheim Fellowship. She has received honorary degrees in literature. She was the scholar in residence at the Rockefeller Foundation in Italy. And then, in 1980, she received the Golden Gadfly Award. Jessica Mitford.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, this is the second intimidating thing, being introduced by a judge. You know, you never know if he's going to lock you up later. The first intimidating thing was a note I got saying that this audience is unusually intelligent. I mean, honestly, what can I do? I'll just have to go on in my usual fashion. I'm terribly pleased to be here and delighted to be in Vancouver anyhow. On the subject of this evening, which is the art of muckraking, or inside muckraking. The whole thing of, I'm always asked, well, what is a muckraker? I only found out about it some years ago when Time magazine had an article calling me the queen of the muckrakers. So, of course, I was longing to see what I was queen of. I wasn't too certain what muckrakers were. So I looked it up in the dictionary and discovered that when Theodore Roosevelt was president of the United States, he's the one who coined the word, and it was a pejorative, meaning the man with the muckrake from Pilgrim's Progress, a pejorative coined to describe people like Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens, who, in Roosevelt's view, had gone too far in seeking, you know, the muck, which was going on in government and stuff. So that the first definition in the Oxford English Dictionary was a person who has a depraved interest in what is morally unsavory or scandalous. Well, of course, that does rather describe me in a way. But as time went on, muckraker came up in the world. So the latest dictionary definition is to seek for, expose corruption, real or alleged, on the part of public men and corporations. This isn't a bad goal in a way, you know. So anyway, I thought that I should first start off by explaining how I came to be a muckraker, which wasn't my intention particularly ever, but it seemed to fall into my lap. Well, I think about the time of that article, or perhaps before, after The American Way of Death came out, I had a form from Who's Who asking you to fill out biographical information. It was the kind of form that causes your entire life to go swimming before your eyes, as is supposed to happen to a person drowning. It said, education, principal positions, honors, awards, and prizes. You were supposed to fill these out. So, as the judge indicated, for education, I wrote nil autodidact, because In my family, girls weren't allowed to go to school. There were six daughters and one boy. He went to Eton, but none of us went to school. My mother, however, taught us to read, which turned out useful in the end. There was no chance of going to school or college, so when I was about 12, I started saving up a running away account, planning to, find my own way in the world. By the time I was 19, I'd saved enough, and I ran away to the Spanish Civil War and never came back. So the next thing in the who's who form was principal positions. Well, obviously, with no education whatsoever, the principal positions were rather drab, consisting of things like market research, sales girl, model, a bartender's bouncer, which was more fun than most. By the time of the Second World War, sub-eligible typist, which was it was a cruel designation. It paid $1,400 a year, and sub-eligible, I mean, that was the actual job description. And that was in the days when it was said that the personnel shortage in Washington was so severe that they'd put the applicant into a room with a typewriter and a washing machine, and if she could identify the typewriter, she was hired. Still sub-eligible, though. So, later, I moved to San Francisco and the Oakland area, where I became a member and leader of the Civil Rights Congress in our area. I was the executive secretary of an organization called the Civil Rights Congress, and this was in 49 and through the 1950s. Well, the Civil Rights Congress was on the Attorney General's subversive list, and it was extremely subversive. We were trying to get rights for black people and things that were, First Amendment rights for political dissenters. It really was extremely subversive for its time. And so being on the subversive list, I was constantly getting subpoenas from the House Un-American Activities Committee. And I put these subpoenas down on the Who's Who form under honors, awards, and prizes. But the trouble was that when I came to be close to middle age, say 38 years old, children already in school getting older, 8, 9, and 14, that sort of thing, and I found myself absolutely without any kind of job. Well, I finally found a job, and it was the worst job I've ever had in my life. It was with the San Francisco Chronicle in the classified ad division. What it consisted of was calling people from rival newspapers who'd advertised, say, something for sale, and trying to get them to switch to the Chronicle. The awful thing is, I was incredibly good at it. I won all kinds of prizes, champagne, domestic champagne, tickets to movies, that sort of thing, you see. After 13 weeks and getting all these prizes, I was fired. So, on close observation, it turns out that the FBI tracked me down and caused the boss of this whole outfit to effectuate my firing. My husband, of course, said, well, you knew it was classified work. I then felt sort of... So I began to feel that, here I was, not yet 40, but my life had come to an end. So I started writing, which happens to be the only thing for which you don't need an education, thank God. All you need is pencil and paper and get on with it, So I wrote my first book, Daughters and Rebels. So, but back to the muckraking, which is the point. The first muckraking book I did, and before I even knew what muckraking was The American Way of Death. And this came about, as most things in life seem to, in a very chancy kind of way. In the middle 1950s, sort of about 56, that kind of time, my husband, Bob Trueheft, who's a lawyer in Oakland, had many trade union clients. He represented a number of unions. And he began to notice, to his annoyance and fury, in fact, that whenever the breadwinner of a union family died, the entire death benefit, hard fought for through strikes and struggle and everything, would end up in the pocket of an undertaker. Whether it was $1,000, $1,200, that would be the price of the funeral. So he started organizing the Bay Area Funeral Society, and I'm sure there are similar ones all over Canada now, but this was one of the pioneer societies, a sort of non-profit organization to reduce the high cost of funerals. In other words, the point was that these societies would have a contract with an undertaker to do it all for a fraction of the going rate for the members. So I'm sorry to say I rather mocked the Bay Area Funeral Society. You can probably imagine, you know, what the kind of people they were, Quakers, Unitarians, university egghead types, you know. I mean, those kinds of people get together earnestly to discuss this whole thing of funerals. And I used to rather tease them and call them the necrophilists and ask them how their, you know, about their layaway plan and how it was coming. until Bob started bringing home the trade magazines with wonderful titles, Casket and Sunnyside, and there's Mortuary Management, and my favorite title of all, Concept, the Journal of Creative Ideas for Cemeteries. Well, I mean, if you saw titles like that, you'd immediately be reading all through. My gosh, I found out an entire wonder world of the mortuary that I'd never known existed. I mean, I hadn't realized, you know, that in your perma-seal casket, you could have a choice of foam rubber or inner spring mattress, you know. So I began getting very interested in this. I began sending away for things. For example, well, samples, you know. Well, I mean, I read that there was a thing, an outfit called the Practical Burial Footwear Company in Columbus, Ohio. And so I wrote to the Practical Burial Footwear Company saying I'd like to have some samples of, I mean, I couldn't imagine how practical it would be. So they sent the samples. And they were called the Fitterfoot Oxford, F-I-T-A-F-U-T, Fitterfoot. So the Fitterfoot Oxfords arrived. Well, you know how Oxfords do up at the front? I mean, just to show up this way, you know. These did up the back, too. And there was a leaflet inside saying that these had been specially designed after 2 years of research to fit the deceased foot after rigor mortis sets in. Well, I must say I was stunned by these. Unfortunately, my son, who was 15 years old at the time, wore them all over the house, and they sort of fell apart. They, you know, they weren't that eternal. Then there was another thing that I sent in for, called the Natural Expression Former. Now, this is an embalmer's aid. You have to visualize sort of dentures without the teeth, or, you know, in other words, a kind of thing this shape, more or less moon shape, half moon, goes in here. And after rigmo, as we call it in the trade, you can make it go like this, you see. Lovely expression. The awful thing is, though, that I've left mine in my will and it's going to be... if they can do it. So, I mean, these were some of the things that drew me, like a magnet, towards the funeral industry. You know, by the way, I mean, I still get mortuary management every month. And I get casket and Sunnyside. Well, I mean, you probably like the Atlantic or the New Yorker, but what I like is mortuary management. Especially since they always call me Jessica, which to me is the height of fame. It's like Adlai or Jackie, you know. I mean, to be called Jessica in the columns of mortuary management, which I am every issue, is really lovely. So anyhow, I got onto it and did various things in, you know, in the course of research. For instance, I'd sort of call up undertakers in the area. I remember calling up one and saying that unfortunately my sister was dying and that we'd like that my niece was coming out to make arrangements, and could I talk to him about it? And he said, absolutely. So I said, well, we thought of cremation. Well, he sounded rather sort of sad over that, but he said he could do it anyhow. So I said, well, good, in that case, we won't need a coffin. And he suddenly got very alert. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I mean, we've got a perfectly serviceable station wagon, and we can just sort of take her along to the crematorium. Upon which he said, madam, the average lady has neither the desire nor the facilities for hauling dead bodies, which is rather true, but on the other hand, I wanted to put him to it, you know. Then I went down to Forest Lawn, which was an experience. You probably, most of you have read The Loved One, Evelyn Waugh's description of that amazing cemetery in Los Angeles. So that was one of the sort of bits of research, which was rather nice. I went down there with a young English instructor, I mean, instructor of English, an American, in fact. And I was posing as his aunt. He was my nephew. And our mutual relation, his mother, was dying of a terminal disease. So we went there to sort of have a look at the Forest Lawn facilities. In those days, Forest Lawn Cemetery had billboards all over Los Angeles. They were in a price war with another outfit, Utter McKinley. So the Forest Lawn thing said, full services, $145. So we went there, and the only way you can get in to the actual sort of inner sanctum, which is where the caskets and things are, is by being a bereaved or a potential bereaved. They love the potential bereaveds, you know, because there they go. So this young man and I went in, and we had a long word with the grief counselor. You understand there are no salesmen in Forest Lawn. There are only grief counselors. So the grief counselor was wonderful, so he was there, and I was crying, and he was. And then I said, I'd like to see over the caskets, you see. So he took us through, and the first casket, now, by the way, this is in early 1960, so triple it for the inflation. The most expensive one, the one that first struck us when we came in, was $15,000. It was sort of a double thing. I can't say how comfortable it was. It was absolutely marvelous looking, with this incredible real silk velvet and everything. So I said, ooh, that's very nice. It's a bit high. Could I see the $145 one? So he looked around all over the place. He couldn't find it. And finally, he fished it out from under a table. My dear, it was purple. And it was absolutely beastly looking, purple. I said, my sister wouldn't be caught dead in there. So we left there. We did have one other thing. We went round Forest Lawn with the Grief Counsellor, who showed us the various plots and how much they cost. And so I said to him, are there any black people buried in Forest Lawn? And he looked at me sort of bland, and I looked back bland. You know the feeling. I mean, you don't want to. So he said, well, no. He said, we used to have a white-only clause in our contract, but since the decisions above ground have gone the other way, real estate, you know, we no longer have that clause, but there are, I don't think there'll ever be any black people buried here. They're so much happier with their own kind. So those were some of the thought of better moments, you know. Anyway, to get on to the rest of muckraking, I had the great pleasure of teaching a course, first at San Jose State University in California and second at Yale. The Yale thing came about as follows. I went to, I was invited to be a distinguished professor, to my great surprise, at Yale, at San Jose State, which amazed me. I mean, since I've never been to school or anything, for me, being a distinguished professor was a great coming up in the world. So I accepted and did go, and it was a course in muckraking that I was doing, in fact. So the only trouble was that they suddenly demanded that I should be fingerprinted. So I refused that, and we had a bit of a hassle. In fact, the most educational part of my entire course there, which was a 3-month stint, was the fingerprint flap. You know, I mean, was it constitutional or wasn't it, and so on. In fact, my great recollection of the whole time was nothing except, you know, courtroom scenes, classroom scenes, a great medley of that kind of thing. So I wrote this up for the Atlantic Monthly in an article called My Short and Happy Life as a Distinguished Professor. So I got a letter from Yale saying, we have no loyalty oath or fingerprinting, come and teach with us, you see. So I did. Anyhow, as a result of these two courses, and as a result of lots of interchange with the students, you know, who are extremely excellent, bright, and everything we like, I developed this book, Poison Penmanship, which is essentially a collection of articles that I've written over the years, pointing out the shortcomings of many of them and what happened as a result of some of them, that kind of thing. Together with the students, worked out a few sort of principles of muckraking, which I thought would be, you know, which were, in fact, kind of basic things that we did. For instance, first off, well, how to do interviewing. Of course, before you even start to interview anybody, the main thing is to find out more about them than they know about themselves, or more about their profession than they know, which isn't as hard as you might think. I mean, there's lots of material available, research material, in libraries, and that's the first place to go. And then, after you've choked down everything you can find out, that's when you go for an interview. So one of the principles that I was suggesting to the students, which I found to be of use, is, well, if you're interviewing what I call a friendly witness, namely somebody who is essentially on your side, well, you number the questions, you get the answers. I never use a tape recorder. I just write them out in a notebook, which I find just as more satisfactory, because I'm always afraid that the tape recorder won't work. But you write out the questions and the answers. But if you're interviewing somebody who you regard as a hostile witness, for instance, in my case, say, well, an undertaker, or a prison administrator when I was preparing my book about prisons. What I do and suggested to the students would be a good thing is to list my questions numbered from kind to cruel. Well, see, the kind questions are to put the person at his ease. In other words, you know, let's say you're sitting in the office of an undertaker. Now, you know they don't like being called undertakers. They're funeral directors. So the first question would be something like, how did you first get interested in funeral directing as a profession? You've now used two important words, funeral directing and profession. They like to think of themselves as being a profession. And you go on like this for, you know, and get them all in a good mood. And then you pop the cruel question, which in this case could be, what's the wholesale cost of the casket that you retail for $6,000? That's a closely held trade secret. I mean, he's bound to blurt out something, you see. I mean, it's a technique that at least I found useful. Prison administrators, a kind question would be, could you suggest some reading that might help me understand more about corrections? Now, note that I use the word corrections. I hope you all realize there are no more prisons left anywhere. They're all corrections. There are no more guards. They're correctional officers. These cosmetic changes in the vocabulary were made some years ago. And so we have departments of corrections, not departments of prisons, you see. And they like to be corrections. It sounds sort of better. Just like funeral director sounds better than undertaker. So you say, well, could you suggest some reading that might help me to understand more about corrections? Which puts you in the position of, oh, I want to learn, sort of thing, and also they know it's corrections. So you keep that up for a while, and then you spring the cruel. How do you justify censoring prisoner's mail to his lawyer in direct violation of the California law? And then he's going to blurt out something, you see. I mean, these are some of the things. I just wanted to get one of these books out, if I've got them. Oh, here they are, good. That's it. So these are just sort of some of the techniques that we did discuss. The thing that I found absolutely invaluable when, as I indicated, when doing The American Way of Death were the trade magazines. I mean, that book couldn't have been written without mortuary management and so forth. So that when I was investigating the prisons, I had the idea that somewhere in the US, there must be a sort of equivalent of Casket and Sunnyside for the prison people, for wardens, that sort of thing, you see. So, finally, I got a clue to the existence of it. And this was in a sort of one of these stuffy, unreadable sociological magazines called the American Journal of Correction. So looking through there, there was a sort of gossip column called News from the Affiliated Organizations. And I saw my name in there, so I read more closely. It said, wardens talk about hostile news reporting. G. Norton Jameson, editor of The Grapevine, mimeographed monthly of the American Association of Wardens and Superintendents, in its November 29th issue, wrote about an interesting contrast between words spoken by Warden Lash, his real name, of the Indiana State Penitentiary, and Jessica Mitford. And then the article went on to say, Miss Mitford is noted for her caustic pen. her kind of reporter is one of the realities of life in these troubled times. Well, so, needless to say, I was now longing for the grapevine. I mean, that was what I wanted. Well, there was a young undergraduate at Cal who was helping me, called Kathy Mill, and she was helping me with research. And I said, Kathy, we've got to get the grapevine. How shall we get, you know, 12 issues? We didn't even know where it was published. Well, I called around the country to various disaffected people in departments of corrections, which I had many, sort of spies, and one of them finally sent me a copy of the grapevine in a plain envelope, mind you. Honestly, she was terrified that her cover would be blown and she'd be known to have sent it. So I found out that it was published in a box from a box number in Sioux Falls, Dakota. So we had the address. So I said to Kathy, now you've got to devise a letter which will spring forth a lot of copies of the grapevine, a year's back issues. And I suggested that what she ought to do is to say that she was a student at the University of California School of Criminology, which was then under great attack by the right wing for being too radical, and say that she'd seen the grapevine and would love to have these copies because she thought they were better, you know. I said, you better sign a man's name. Correction is, you know, a man's world, more or less. So she signed Carl Mill, K-A-R-L, which I thought sounded sort of vaguely subversive, Carl. So, well, I changed that to Kenneth. And we sent the letter off. So in the course of time, 12 copies of the grapevine arrived at Kathy Mill's house. And so I went through them with fascination. They were a goldmine of just what I expected, the sort of material that made great quotes, you know, and with the truth of what the wardens thought about things. I mean, for example, there were exchanges of opinion on how to circumvent judicial rulings in favor of prisoners' rights, how the wardens can get round those, and how to avoid investigation of prison conditions by the state legislature. For instance, here's a quote from the grapevine that I used in the book. Warden Frank Iman of Arizona State Prison revealed that he had refused three black legislators admittance beyond his office to meet with black prisoners last year. They stormed out of his office in a rage. He said, I'll make Attica look like a picnic. See, now this is them. So I was, well, I spent the most delightful afternoon underlining copies of the grapevine until I came across this on the last page of the last issue, quote, the following letter may be helpful in dispelling the idea that not much can be learned at the college level concerning the operation of prisons. Real intelligence is where you find it. Here is a young man who sees much farther than many and questions the soundness of the college courses. Now, he just could be right, and someday he might make a top-notch prison administrator. Dear Mr. Jameson, as a graduate student in criminology at the University of California, I was very impressed with a copy of your publication, The Grapevine, which I ran across here at school. I have long felt that my education here has been jammed into a liberal mold of propaganda. I see your publication as a credible news source of our profession, undistorted by the rampant, irresponsible, and unrealistic biases of the media and campus liberals. Your publication offers the real current news. After all, as prison staff members, you are the people who know what's really going on in our prisons. I am tired of reading the sentimental fantasies of reporters like Jessica Mitford. How can I obtain the issues of the past year? I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for your work. Sincerely, Kenneth Mill. So that was, you know, I mean, you have to get information in some way. One of the things that's often asked is, Is there, I mean, what good does muckraking do in the end? Well, it's hard to say. For one thing, muckraking is too narrow a category in a sense. I know that Lincoln Steffens began to take a dim view. He thought that it only glosses over faults of society that go too deep to do, for just his muckraking to do any good. You know, on the other hand, we know that successful muckrakers, like Woodward and Bernstein, for instance, have toppled presidents, and that the Vietnamese war was largely, I mean, the whole unfolding of what happened in that war began with young journalists like Robert Scheer, whose very early pamphlet called How the U.S. Got Involved in Vietnam sparked teach-ins and whole campus demonstrations that went on that finally toppled another president, LBJ. So it can do good. I can't possibly claim to be, you know, in that high category, because I must say that, as the definition said, I'm sort of more interested in sort of small depraved corners, in a way. So, but on the other hand, looking back over what's happened to funerals in the United States, I don't know, perhaps in Vancouver, you don't have funerals. I've just arrived, so I'm not sure what you'd do. But there's been quite a difference in America. When I was preparing the American Way of Death, the cremation statistics were about 3.5% of all Americans were cremated. Today, it's pushing 11%. Well, let's see, this book came out in 63, so that's 20 years. Even so, it's not a bad record, you know, for it to have increased about 3 times. But it's very regional in character. In other words, in the Deep South, there's very little cremation. But Marin County, the most affluent county in California, home of the Cuisinart, home of the hot tub, home of the split-level dwelling, more than 50% are cremated today. Now, this absolutely strikes fear into the hearts of undertakers. There was a very sad article in Mortuary Management about the death rate. You see, the thing is that the death rate's going down. In other words, what the article said was that because of the 55-mile speed limit and also, well, you know, sort of medical advances, cancer and heart attacks and things, that the death rate keeps falling. And which is a disaster because, unlike any other commodity, the funeral director's market is fixed or inelastic. I mean, you know, the television salesman can offer, you know, one for every room. The car salesman, one for each member of the family. But with funerals, as you perhaps have noticed, it's one to a customer. So when the when the death rate goes down, the howls go up for most people. And so they really hate the cremation, which is the new thing, you know, direct cremation, meaning you pick up the body and burn. Well, the undertakers call it burn and scatter, or even bake and shake. But, and that makes them. Makes them really sad. So maybe I may have contributed a wee bit to burn and scatter and bake and shake, you know, but I wanted to end up by saying a few things about publishing, writing. I mean, how you do it in the end, and what's coming up next sort of thing. Well, I had great difficulties in publishing The American Way of Death, because the thing is that in writing it, I decided to give an absolute description of embalming, which happens, incidentally, to 99.9% of every American without any consultation. This disgusting procedure takes place to create a beautiful memory picture, which indeed, in turn, requires a beautiful container and the expensive whole thing to put it in. You see, in other words, embalming is the crux of the profit in funeral directing, and is also the thing that distinguishes American funerals from those in anywhere else in the world, unless you go back to ancient Egypt, where people were embalmed. I mean, it doesn't happen anywhere else. So, trying to sort of think of a nice way to put the embalming, which is a pretty disgusting procedure, what I did was to cast it in, the mortuary people's own list of okay words. In other words, they caution, they publish all this stuff in mortuary management and casket and Sunnyside, which is, you shouldn't sort of speak of the corpse or the body. You should say no, you should say Mr. Jones or young Master Jones if it's a child and that sort of thing. So, and then they don't speak of a morgue, but of the slumber room, So trying to do it this way, I hope to make it fairly amusing and put the body is first laid out in the undertaker's morgue, or rather Mr. Jones is reposing in the slumber room to be ready to bid the world farewell. Then I go on this way, and sort of what happens to wretched Mr. Jones, Patching and filling completed, Mr. Jones is now shaved, washed, and dressed, and so on. Seeing how cream-based cosmetic, available in pink flesh, suntan, brunette, and blonde, I've got all the, I know all that, is applied to his hands and face, hair shampooed and combed, and so on. So, anyhow, I wrote this up at some length, and only to get back an absolute shower of disapproval from both the publishers that had agreed to take the book, both one in England and one in America, saying, this material is too revolting, it's got to go. I was faced with, I don't know if you can believe how depressing it is when you've written a lot of stuff, you've got the manuscript around, and to get this sort of reaction. So I said, well, I'm going to mimeograph it. This was before the days of Xerox, and just sell it to anybody who wants it. And I'm withdrawing it. Because they said, if you cut this out, we might be able to publish the rest of it. I wasn't going to. My brilliant agent then turned around and got Simon & Schuster to read it. And they loved all that embalming stuff. And so anyhow, the rest is history. They published it. But to my interest, this very section about Mr. Jones in the slumber room was chosen by several college textbooks as examples of, style of writing or something. So to me, I felt slightly vindicated after that. Well, so anyway, publishers can pose a threat, although they don't mean to. I mean, I think that they sincerely said they thought this material was too revolting for general readership. But that was a long time ago. The new threat coming up, I don't know whether this exists in Canada, but certainly does in the United States, is the threat from the far right in general and from the moral majority specifically. Well, I've had a couple of run-ins with these people. There was one, a few years, just a very few years ago, I was giving a lecture tour in the South, various colleges, and one of the places that asked me to speak was the OHUP Public Library in Vidalia, Georgia. Well, I'd never heard of Vidalia, and it turns out that it's such a tiny town that even people 100 miles away in Savannah have never heard of it. But it soon got on the map, because what they were having in the OHUP Public Library was a series on death. Now, death is very big in the colleges and so on these days, as you've probably noticed. But anyway, this, you have a philosopher, a clergyman, and so forth, different aspects of death. And I think I'm dragged in for the sort of comic relief about the death industries. In any event, the OHUP Public Library in Vidalia asked me to speak on a certain Tuesday. I was the lead off, and then every other Tuesday they'd be having these clergymen and others, aspects of death. So no sooner had my speech been announced than the American Legion attacked, and they came up with all the Un-American Activity Committee material about me from the 1950s, and they splashed this all over the place. So the Savannah newspapers took that up, and then the librarians fought back, saying that, citing First Amendment rights, everybody has his or her right to have his say in the OHUP Public Library, said they. And so when I got there, because of all this enormous, flap in the papers, it was supposed to be a small hall for 50, 60 people. They moved it to the high school auditorium, and the thing was packed in Vidalia, Georgia. So I was terribly pleased to see all this. So the chairman of the meeting started off in the same way the librarians had sent their message, saying that in the interests of fairness and free speech, they'd invited members of the funeral profession from miles around, and he said, are any funeral directors here? Upon which 12 black suits rose. They were all sitting together, 12. And then he said, in other words, they'd sent free tickets to everybody they could think of. So then I gave my talk, and after that, there was questions. So the first, the thing is that when you talk about funerals, almost everybody in that audience had either had to arrange a funeral for someone, and all of them had their own horror stories that they were longing to tell about what happened with the funeral director and the overcharges and stuff. But in following the chairman's lead, I said, well, now we'll have the question period, and first off, I wonder if any of the members of the funeral profession would like to start with a question, if so. So a black suit got up, and he said, I am a vault man. I sell vaults. I am a vault man. I sell vaults. Well, that's how he pronounced it. And he said, I listened to Miss Mitford's talk, and she didn't say that Jesus Christ our Lord was given a vault by a rich man. So I said, well, I spend a lot of my time in motels as I travel a great deal. Consequently, I'm quite a student of the Bible. That's all they give in the motel. I said, I'm very aware of the story of Joseph of Arimathea and the fact that he did indeed give his tomb to Jesus, but I don't think Jesus was there all that long. He seemed to be up and gone in no time, So, anyway, then I mean, but the encouraging thing about Fidelia was that the audience were, you know, I mean, we're talking about the Bible Belt. It's a rather sinister part of the country very often. But the audience were against the black suits on the whole, you know. They had their own stories of what they wanted to say. So that was encouraging. But there was one final thing about the, well, the moral majority. I don't know if any of you have seen one of those at all. I mean, close up. Perhaps they're not. But I saw one the other, not long ago. I mean, I actually met one of them face to face, and this was in a large conclave of librarians in Idaho. I think there might have been about 2,000 librarians. It was a Middle Western convention of librarians from all over the place. And librarians to me are the first bulwark of freedom against censorship. They really are up on a platform, and there were, you know, it was imagine a vast audience, and then there were a few people on in a panel, of which I was one, and one of them was this moral fellow, and the others were librarians, you know, and the subject was censorship, you see. Now, the moral man his name was Michael Ferris from the state of Washington, and remember that name because some of the librarians said that with his energy and outlook, he may soon be a congressman, and then what? Who knows? I mean, perhaps the president of the United States. Stranger things have happened. He was one of these sort of clean-cut young chaps, aged 30. I remember that the students used to say, "Don't trust anybody over 30," and we used to say, "Don't trust anybody under 80," because that was the days when W.E.B. Du Bois, Bertrand Russell, and Alexander Micklejohn were all over 80, and they were trustworthy. Well, this fellow was exactly 30, so he fell between all stools. So the main targets of his talk in the panel were a book called The Learning Tree and a bestseller called Our Bodies, Ourselves, which I can't say I've read, but it's... I'm sure many of you have. I mean, it's supposed to be a very excellent book. So Michael Ferris was explaining that he has three little daughters, the oldest of which is 6 years old, and he does not want this six-year-old child, who already goes to the library, exposed to explicit sexual material, he said, which is contained in Our Bodies, Ourselves. So he called on all right-minded, so to speak, librarians to refuse to put these on the shelves. In fact, he's bringing a lawsuit in the state of Washington to have these books banned. So the librarians fought back valiantly at length, you know, and they were citing the First Amendment. They spoke of the danger that any form of censorship could lead to. Well, when it came my turn, luckily, I happened to have on me a mailing from the Reverend Jerry Falwell, who's the foremost guru of people like Mr. Ferris. Well, on the envelope of the mailing was stamped adults only. Well, I immediately thought, you know, it was an invitation to any child worth its salt to rip that open and see what was inside. But I didn't go into that. Anyhow, Reverend Falwell's letter was an amazing document. And it was very reminiscent to me of the FBI file which I got under the Freedom of Information Act some few years ago when I was preparing my book. And so the FBI file goes, subject, which is me, scene entering, blank, 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 whole page cut out, 10 cents Xerox for each page, or subject, was heard talking to blank, you know. In other words, the FBI dossiers are a series of blanks, which I've been appealing without much luck so far. So anyhow, but this is the way that Reverend Falwell's letter went. For instance, on this book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, he had blanked out what he conceived to be the dirty words, with a really curious effect. Example, from Our Bodies, Ourselves, Reverend Falwell quoted, "As we moved our bodies to the music, I could feel his blank and his blank pressing on me." So I said to the librarians that, well, no wonder Mr. Farris doesn't want his six-year-old reading this book, because a chap with two of those, she'll just be... live the rest of her life in disappointment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to have questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are, as I indicated earlier, people in other lecture rooms, and Ms. Mitford will go there first for a few minutes to answer questions directly to those people, because they've been good enough to stay for the evening and see her on television. They should have the opportunity of seeing her in person. So then she will come back here and answer questions in this room.
Oh, right. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'll see you shortly.
You have to tell me where to go.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jessica Mitford is going to answer a few questions and then go to room one, so that everyone assembled will have a chance to see her. We'll start off with the first couple of questions, and then I'll go and get her an ashtray. She really needs a cigarette after this long performance. So, what is the first question?
I enjoyed your talk very much, Mr. I'd like to ask you whether your Spanish Civil War experience was any help in living in America under the current administration?
That's a very good question. Actually, well, I suppose you might say that one's whole life is a preparation for this administration. I mean, after all, fascism was incipient, Toryism was rampant all during my childhood,
wasn't just the Spanish experience, but I think, you know, that's a good point. Yeah. I've never looked it up, but I suppose they put in what I said. I hope so.
Is it true that you're working on a second book called The American Way of Death, Part 2?
You mean The Son of the American Way of Death?
The Resurrection.
Ah. No, I wish I was. Yeah.
I read your article.
Yes.
And we're all aware of the difficulties and the inequities in the American system. And we also read about the great movement, the inequities in the American system. How do you feel about the American system versus the Russian system? I'm sure there's been a bad role.
Well, I think, I mean, the point of the Communist Party at the time that I joined it, and through the time that I was in it, was really to find an indigenous road to socialism. In other words, some alternative to the rotten system that we're now all suffering under. And that was it. You see, in other words, along the way, clearly, would be things like the struggle for the rights of black people, etc., which was the biggest part of what I was doing, in fact, in the party, and where the party was the clear leader. In other words, the liberals had turned tail in a very disgraceful fashion all during the early 1950s, as soon as the McCarthy terror began to hit. They really did. They didn't take a stand. The ACLU, in fact, expelled members of the Communist Party from its organization, which they've since stated publicly, you know, that they regret and apologize for doing. But it was an awful time. And the only people who seemed to me to be totally staunch and withstanding all of these absurd fluctuations were indeed the American Communist Party. But then they did change. I mean, that is, they remained very, very hidebound and totally dominated, really, by the Soviet policy, foreign policy, so that they got more and more isolated from the very people they were trying to influence, namely, you know, the trade unions, the minorities, and so on. So that was when I left in 1958. Anyone else? Yeah.
Your family seems to have taken some rather unusual political and philosophical directions. What do you mean
that? Why did they?
Yeah, why?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, say, I suppose people do get different messages from what's happening. I was born in 1917, so that by the time Hitler came into power, which was 33, I was 15 years old. And then the Depression, you know, hit England just about the same as it did anywhere. In other words, vast areas declared unemployables, that sort of thing, great marches of the unemployed on London. So I, as a teenager living in the deep country, was fascinated by these developments and also by the views of people, perhaps, you know, some of them 10, 15 years older than me, the intellectuals of that time, who saw socialism as the answer to all of these threats. I think that really, if you can put things in a context, I don't know, you know, where you were brought up, what your childhood was like, but that's what affects you, is the is the influences of what's going on outside, so that the 30s were a highly political decade where people took sides, and I took my side.
One more question, then we're going to two other rooms, if you'll excuse us. I'm sorry to give you so much trouble. Any other question?
Yes, lady. How did I get an agent?
I've heard that it's hard to get an agent until you're already.
It's terribly difficult. It's really absurd because it's a vicious circle. Yeah, you know, I mean, you can't get. Publishers won't read what you send unless it's recommended by an agent. Agents are getting the same. They're terribly hard to get. My first agent was somebody who'd represented the Hollywood 10 and the other Hollywood dissidents, you know, and had stuck by them in the 40s and that sort of thing, and in the 50s. He's no longer working as an agent. Then I got an English agent just by luck. And as soon as you get something published, everything changes. I, for instance, offered an article which was literally an outline for The American Way of Death. Turned down everywhere, absolutely. And it had the same sort of, information, really, that the book did. So it finally ended up in a tiny little magazine with 2,000 circulation in Los Angeles. And that's really what started it all, because then the Bay Area Funeral Society republished thousands of them as sort of propaganda for the Funeral Society movement. This came to the attention of, believe it or not, Caspar Weinberger. Yes, and he was a good liberal, and he had a weekly television show called Profile Bay Area. And so he asked me and a Unitarian minister to have a debate with two undertakers whose names were Dr. Sly and Mr. Grimm. Well, anyway, the debate was marvelous. It was a comedy act, as you can imagine. And this came to national attention. Eventually, the Saturday Evening Post published an article, and that was the beginning of The American Way of Death. And we're talking about the 50s, you know. I had no idea that Cap Weinberger, as we used to call him, would turn out to be such a rotter. He'll put... Anyway, I mean, I know we're for cremation, but not his way. Not all together.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah. Thank you. I see the no smoking sign, but I'm doing it anyway.
Go ahead. We have time for a few questions here, and then we'll have to go back. Did you hear them from the next hall? That's fine, then. No, it was hard to get the questions. Who's first? Good.
I don't have a question, but I'd just like to tell you that I've admired you for a long time, and I'm very, very happy to see you here in Vancouver. And welcome.
Thank you.
Is there a question here? Yes.
What did you think of the televised version of Love, Nicole, Kleiner?
Whose version?
The BBC version.
Oh, the question was, what did I think of... I better repeat it, because nobody could hear. Love in a Cold Climate, my sister Nancy's book, was done on BBC, or Thames or something. Yes. Yeah. Anyhow, it was dreadful, I thought. I thought it was absolutely awful. I couldn't bear it. Everything. In other words, I don't know, all the jokes got missed somehow. And I thought the casting was dreadful. They didn't look anything like us. Just as well, you'll say.
Another question? If not, we'll go then. Oh, I see.
I'll ask a question. Last night's paper carried an interview with Nicholas Mifflin, and in which it said that you've been asked to write a book about Margaret Thatcher's England. Have you accepted?
The question was, have I been asked to write a book about Margaret Thatcher's England? The answer is, it's not a book, it's an article for The Observer. And yes, I have accepted. It's going to be called Margaret Thatcher's Britain, An Exile's View. I'm the exile.
Yes.
Do you think it's going to be any easier in the 80s to be a strong woman than it was in the 30s and 40s?
The question is, would it be easier in the 80s to be a strong woman than in the 30s or 40s? I should think it's about the same any old decade. I don't see, in other words, you know, it depends on you, I think. I don't see it's going to be any harder. I think in a way the 50s were perhaps hard on a lot of people.
One more question at the back.
Do you think there's more muckraking in the States than there is in Britain? Well, my answer to that is that in Britain, because of the outrageous secret, Official Secrets Act, it's almost impossible to do anything. For instance, my book about prisons would have been impossible to write in England because reporters are banned at the whim of the Home Secretary from anything that the Home Secretary deems to be confidential, which he can say anything is, you know. Reporters have a dreadful time there, and the libel laws and everything else militates much against them.
Will you excuse us if we go back now to one more, and then to the main, from which you'll hear? Thank you. Been able to hear the questions in the other rooms? All right, we'll go right ahead and then we're returning to Theater 2. Who? Yes.
What can commoners or amateur muckrakers do about the present U.S. administration?
The question was, I have to repeat it because they can't hear otherwise, what could ordinary people do about the present administration in the U.S., you mean, or Canada or both. Yeah. Well, they're doing a great deal. It's so odd the way the newspapers underreport certain things happening. For example, I'm going to England on Sunday, and there's a young woman coming to live in my house to be a house sitter and look after things, and she put down on the calendar, I'm going to jail on the 20th of June, so be back before then, which I will. In other words, she's part of an enormous effort which has been going on, and which is very important, really, around Livermore and those parts where they create, you know, atomic things. And they're really doing a huge job with enormous support. And of course, you've read, you know, what the churches, etc., are doing, and so on. So that, in other words, it's by no means just muckrakers, it's people doing things that count.
The back.
I have a friend who's working on a piece of investigative journalism, and she's been getting threatening phone calls this week. Do you have any particular suggestions as to how to respond to threatening phone calls?
The question was that a friend is writing some investigative journalism and getting threatening phone calls, and how should one respond? Well, I suppose it depends on what they say. I mean, if they ring up in the middle of the night and say, you'll be dead tomorrow, I just say, shut up and go to sleep, you know. But it really depends very much on the nature of the threats and what, you know, sort of how important they are. I suppose that if they got worse than just an ordinary death threat, which is nothing, you might call the police. I'm not sure, but it all I mean, this would depend on your friend's judgment, what she's doing, and what the threats in fact amount to for her. There's no sort of pat answer, I think, you know. I hope she's all right.
I feel for Mr. Ferris's daughter and the injustice that that man is bringing upon his daughter in making or trying to make our bodies ourselves unavailable. But the fact of the matter is today that pornography is a massive growth industry in North America, and that were that literature directed against any other identifiable group, black people, Semitic people, whatever, we would be able to recognize that as the hate literature that in fact it is. And would you comment upon, please, pornography and that, your views of censorship and what?
Yeah. Now the question really was that, what do you think about pornography? Should it be censored or not? Because the speaker was pointing out that if it was material directed against, say, blacks or something, it would be easily identifiable and perhaps punished as such. Actually, I can only say that I'm against any censorship, including of pornography. I'm also terribly sad to tell you that I've never seen a dirty film. I mean, well, I did see a semi-dirty film. It was Last Tango, which I thought was so incredibly boring that I've never seen another. So I guess that I don't think that pornography creates violence and so on. In fact, there have been studies about what goes on in Denmark and stuff. I think that any form of censorship is a great danger. That's my answer.
One here and one there.
Following on the muckraking that you've done, I have a suggestion, if I may be so bold. Your experience beginning back in England in the 30s up to now would qualify you most successfully to deal with the people in power who not only encouraged Hitler to come to power and support him, but now the same crowd in the modern time are promoting nuclear war. People talk about the bomb and how bad it is, but not many of them deal with the kinds of people that are promoting war.
I agree with that. In other words, the question said that having lived in England through the rise of fascism and in Europe in those days, the importance of identifying the same crowd who are now for the bomb and also the same crowd who are anti-Semites and everything. I think that that's right, and I think things are being done along those lines. A friend of mine is, in fact, writing a book about the roots of English fascism.
And the last question.
After all your experiences, do you still see socialism as the alternative to the system we have now in North America?
Sorry, could you say that?
After all your experiences, do you still see socialism as the alternative to the system that we have now in North America?
Yes, the question is, after all these experiences, do you still see socialism as a good alternative to what we've got in North America? Yes, because I can't see any other way unless people take control of their own lives and of the means of production. I can see no future of decency or anything. And I think that all the things that have been talked, you know, for example, the bomb, which this last speaker mentioned and so on, come from the fact that people are virtually powerless as long as the power remains in a few hands. Thank you.
Yes,
you,
fine. I didn't
do
care.
It.
All right, I'll do it, yeah.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Just say, any questions?
I think there should be some questions.
Are there any more questions?
Did you all hear what was going on in the other room?
Oh, good. There's someone.
Press consuls? What?
Well,
when you say press, you mean organizations of newspaper people? What are they?
Press consuls, which are made up of representatives from the press as well.
Yeah. The question was about press councils. I'm not terribly informed on them, so I'm sure that I don't know what they are exactly. I have another question. Yeah.
Most enjoying your type of humor and everything. Have you ever thought of writing a play about it?
The question was, have I ever thought of writing a play? The answer is, what I'd like to be is a character actress. I'd like to be in a play.
I think you are.
I think that's about it.
Could you share with us your plan for your next muckraking book?
The answer, the question is, what's my next muckraking book? The answer is, unfortunately, the next book I'm doing, which I've almost finished, is a memoir of a friend, Philip Toynbee, who died a couple of years ago. So it's not really muckraking, or it may be a bit.
Oh,
You can't write about Friends without raking, but what?
I'm curious to know whether there are any laws, state laws, which encourage some of the practices that you referred to in your book.
What sort of thing? Oh, the question was, are there any state laws that encourage such practices as embalming? Answer, no. There is absolutely no law requiring that. There's no law even requiring a casket or a coffin to be buried or cremated in. These are all private industry rules.
Oh, yeah. Very pleased that you escaped Eton, and I wonder how the fact that you didn't go to school influenced how you raised your own children.
The question was, glad that you escaped Eton, but how did the fact that you escaped school altogether influence the way you raised your children? Well, I thought they'd have a lovely time at school. My vision was that the entire knowledge of mankind would be spread before them for their enjoyment. It wasn't a bit like that at Oakland Technical High School where they went. I think it's about enough, don't you? Should we have one more?
Yes, let's have one more.
Just one more. Right. There's one. The question had to do with nursing homes and their collusion with funeral parlours, am I right? In other words, they... Yeah, and the funeral plans, which are sort of burial plans, you know, which you pay, and it's kind of insurance, isn't it? Pre-need. Yeah. Well, there are terrible abuses in those places. I know about that, but again, the only thing you can do is to protest them. I wish you'd all come to my funeral. I've already got it planned. I've been to many memorial services lately, and I can't say how long drawn out they are. You know, people talking on for ages. Mine, I've got the slogans prepared. It's going to be brevity followed by levity. And nobody can speak more than 2 minutes, and then lots of food and drink. It ought to be the best of the year. You're all invited. Thank you.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, to express our gratitude to Ms. Mitford, I would ask Mr. Davey to speak to us.
Talk about being intimidated. How do you follow that? I do have a message for the Mounties in the audience. You see, I told you she was harmless. Wicked, dangerous, but not really subversive. I think the reaction you've had from the audience here, Miss Mitford, and from the audience in the other room, and the fact other rooms, and the fact that Vancouver has turned out this kind of an overflow interest in what you had to say is testimony enough of our thanks to you. I should tell you that we at the Sun, because we ceased to be the Vancouver Sun today and will become the Sun on Monday, we're in the process of a name change. For the next month, we're going to call ourselves Mortuary Management. Out of deference to the two grief counselors who are contesting the election in this province. I spent Wednesday night flying back from Toronto and finishing Poison Penmanship because I was attracted to it first because on the back cover, she's taken it away with her, is a magnificent picture of Miss Mitford in a deerstalker hat, and as one of the other few people in Vancouver who sometimes affects a deerstalker hat, I was immediately attracted to the book. For all the journalists in the audience and would-be journalists in the audience, it's a magnificent primer, as Carl Bernstein says, of investigative journalism. But with all the advice Miss Mitford hands out in the book, she left out the most important thing, that ridicule is still the best weapon. She's the mistress of it, and we thank you for demonstrating that so aptly tonight.
Thank you.